Blog Talk Radio.
Death row, then and now. It is a daunting task to describe death row, that peculiarly American institution
out of battery,
where men, women were sent to rot, to sit, to die.
Power off.
Oops, sorry about that, family. Something happened with the speaker unexpectedly. We're going to redo that in a few moments, so bear with me. But in the meantime, we want to thank all of you for tuning in to this segment of New Day, Resurrection and Liberation. Of course, we were just attempting to hear from Mumia Abu-Jamal. That was, of course, one of his latest commentaries just recorded a few days ago. Before I re-cue that up for you, I want to thank everyone that came out today, both on Zoom and, of course, physically at the One Art Center. Very, very good session, family. And we knew that that was going to happen because we've been working diligently for that to happen, meaning we had the opportunity to talk about a couple of the platform issues as it pertains to recharge genocide. And, you know, we've been talking about that for quite a while now, a couple of years, actually five to be exact, as quiet as it's kept. And so we're now ready to bring it forward. Recharge Genocide 21 is what our program project is about. And today's topic was gentrification. Yep, gentrification. And we talked about it in the context of human rights violations, which is very different from what most talk about when they talk about gentrification. But we've broken it down into a science, because they've broken it down into a science. And so today we had the opportunity to talk with folks from Newark, from Trenton, of course from Philly, But from other cities, too. I don't remember exactly which one Brother Shep came in from New York. And again, we are examining gentrification in the context of genocide. Now, again, that's not something that most really do, and it's okay. We're doing it. And doing it in the context of when we talk about reparations, well, there's a lot of discussion about that now, and there's a lot of different angles, meaning there's no one way to discuss it, to get it, to focus on whatever. There's different aspects, different dimensions. Well, ours is from a human rights platform dimension approach. Most are dealing with it from a civil rights approach, and that's fine. We support that. It's okay. But we are very specific in that, yes, it is civil rights that we're dealing with. Yes, it is, you know, other aspects of it that we'll be dealing with. But Brother Malcolm and others taught us we have to focus on human rights. That is what he did in 1964. And as quiet as it's kept, Queen Mother Moore and others did also. So it wasn't just reparations in the context from a civil rights aspect. It's a little deeper than that. So today we had the opportunity to kind of go into some of that. I mean, we weren't able to go far, but we definitely touched upon it in such a way that people now have another kind of aspect to this. Our formula is what we call R4J. The letter R, the number 4, the letter J, meaning there's four areas that we're focusing on in terms of reparatory justice, and that is reparations, restitution, retribution, and restoration. Those are all areas in law. They have different applications. They have different objectives and so forth. So we were fortunate enough to be able to, you know, to realize that that's kind of how that was structured. I mean, there's other aspects even more than that. But those are the four that we are presently addressing and dealing with. And so today we had a wonderful conversation and allow people to talk about gentrification on how they see it and know it. And, you know, some of them literally have experienced losing their properties or taxes going up and things of that nature. Our position, and we wanted people to hear that because this is the kind of stuff that people have been talking about for at least two decades. But what we wanted to do was, and we did, to introduce that we have a different approach. And our different approach is that, again, we're not trying to do it the way that most do, which is through the courts in a way of following their process and procedures. If we're talking about reparatory justice, why should we be trying to follow the same process and procedures that everybody else do? And so tonight, family, what we want to talk about in that same mindset is, as many probably are aware, a decision came down this week dealing with affirmative action. Well, we knew that was coming, and it just shows you if you really pay attention, study our history, then you'll kind of get to know somewhat might be coming. Do y'all remember something called the Bakke case? Well, if you're not familiar with it, you should be. Because that was one of the first cases that really received not only recognition but a lot of support when a off-white person filed a discrimination suit in regards to affirmative action. I think this was probably like maybe 1979, 80, somewhere around that time period. But the point is, we knew that this was going to be a problem because that case went all over the country. That wasn't like some isolated case. So we're going to talk a little bit about that later, not much, because for real, our focus is self-determination. And so we're going to leave a lot of the civil stuff to other people, let them for other aspects of our people. Let them do that. We want to focus on what we need to do to be as free as possible, as self-governing as possible. That's our position. It doesn't mean that we won't support others and their positions. It's, we just let you know what ours is. And again, we want to be self-determined, possible. In fact, one of our new brands that you will hear us talk about very soon is called Our Own Forever. Our Own, the number four, ever. That's one of our new brands, one of our new products coming. So, again, family, we have really taken the time to map some things out for you. We have to begin to make certain that we have our own of everything. And that's the whole point, meaning we don't want to keep depending on other people. It's not to say that we don't have certain rights or we shouldn't fight for certain rights, but simultaneously, we need to be fighting for our own stuff, and that's where we're at with it. And anyway, family, tonight we're going to talk about affirmative action a little bit, what that means in real time. Are we really seeing the writing on the wall? Are we really trying to prepare, knowing, seeing right before our eyes what this government is doing and getting ready to do and making certain that it cuts us off as much as possible in every way possible? Are we going to still continue to fight in that manner? These are some of the things that we must begin to look at, examine, and be prepared for. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. Now, on our live line tonight, we are going to talk with two brothers. One, one of my elders, Baba Bambozi Shango, is going to be joining us because On June 29th, we commemorated the Born Day / Earth Day of Kwame Ture, ancestor Kwame Ture. And so one of the things that the Million Woman World March is about to do, so that you know that this is really a movement and not just a march, we're getting ready to hold some of our first pre-sessions. One of those pre-sessions is going to be for Black students. Yeah, we're going to do national Black student conferences, symposiums, and other kinds of interactions with Black students so that we can begin organizing them, educating them, mobilizing them, etc. So when we talk about Baba Kwame Ture, we're going to be sharing, I mean, how did he get started as a student? And so it's so important that we connect the Black dots in such a way that we're able to show the importance of the Black student movement. That's right. And so tonight we're going to talk with Baba Bozi Shango, who's going to tell us a lot about Baba Kwame Ture. And we're going to focus particularly on when he was a student and then how he evolved from that, right? So we're going to talk a little bit about that. As we get ready to deal with our Black student conferences that will be coming up, where one of the focuses is going to be to make sure that they know the history of the Black student movement in the U.S. and how some of that connected to the diaspora, such as Stephen Biko, Soweto, and others. That's right. We're going to make sure that our students know about our students, some of what they actually did in real time. We're going to talk about that, because if we do not give them that information, that means they continue to go to college and end up working and serving who? And again, it's really on us that we're not providing foundations in our communities, our own institutions, that give them that information. I was telling Baba Bambozi earlier that how I ended up in college, I didn't go to college to go to college. I had no real ambition about going to college to get a degree. I went to college because I heard about the student movement and I wanted to be involved in that. Unfortunately, by the time I got there, the student movement had really gone, but just little remnants was there. But I was blessed enough to connect with people who were involved in it and was able to build with them over the years. So my point is, we've got to set these foundations for our youth, for our students that are with us presently, as well as to prepare for those who are yet to come. And anyone that really understands organizing, and this is something that Baba Kwame definitely taught and demonstrated, dealing with the student, going to the student campus. I remember him coming to my campus, you see. And so these things are very important. And now over the years, a lot of the campuses have kind of, faded out in terms of their activities, their activeness. Sometimes they'll bring lectures in, but not like they did, that's for sure. And, of course, funding has been lessened now, particularly with the Black student groups, organizations on campuses. The funding has been decreased, which is a whole nother conversation that we're going to have with students, because guess what, y'all? See, me as a student, I used to study how that stuff worked. And most students don't know that your tuition includes student activities. So there is X amount of money that is allocated particularly, specifically for student activities. So if you are an organized body on campus and you are registered as such, you are supposed to be able to get access to the large sums of monies that every student has to pay. Well, the student not paying a large sum, but when you put all that together, it is a large sum. But here's the catch. And I see Brother Baba Bambozi is in queue, so we're going to bring him in. Here's the catch. Most students don't know that there's an actual budget for student activities. the student activity advisor does not tell them that there's thousands upon thousands in particular budget. Therefore, the students only know what they're told minimally, and that is basic stuff. What ends up happening is this. If the money is not utilized from that particular fund every single year, they have to clear it out. It goes into a reserve fund, and then they can use it for whatever. Most student groups and organizations have no idea that that's the way colleges are function. When we were in college, we studied it. So we knew exactly how to maneuver to make sure we could get funding for our lecturers and things like that, because we knew the internal operations and as such called them on it, which is kind of what we did today too at our meeting. But we'll go more into that later. This is some of the information that we're going to start conveying to students, because many of the students are not having ongoing kinds of folk to come to the campus anymore. And a lot of times that is because they are told that there's no funding. That's not true. In every tuition, there's a little thing in there where extracted from, as a part of your tuition, is student activities. And again, we're going to help educate our students. Lastly, about students, for our student conferences, we'll be talking about student loan debt. Meaning, we're glad that whatever just happened with the decision, legislative decision, that fell through. Well, from our perspective, from the We Charge Inside 21 perspective, if our students' parents does not get debt removal first, nobody should be getting it. How does that work that everybody can get it? Or anyone can get it, and the descendants of our people who went through all of that, they're not first in line. So we'll talk more about that later too. All right, family, let's go to our live line, and we are going to talk with Baba Bambozi Shango, and we're going to talk about, of course, ancestor Kwame Ture, a few other things too. But definitely I wanted to spend some time to talk about Baba Kwame Ture, because although I only had a very short visit with him, I can tell you sometimes that's all it takes, y'all, because I left out of that room knowing some of what I now know and was prepared for. In terms of this work. And so be real clear, it's important to connect with folk who have done some of this already as you are growing and learning various things. And so without further ado, let's go to our live line and let's welcome Baba Bambozi Shango's in the house, AAPRPPG. And hey, greetings, Baba. How are you this evening?
Fine, my sister. How are you?
I'm good today. It's been a hectic week. A lot of stuff been going on, but you know, it's all good because we're here. We're here, and as
the
Baba
struggle
was saying,
continues.
Ready,
yes.
That's right. A little continuer. Ready. So I thank you, you know, again for answering my call as you always do. So, but I'm always thankful. For calling you what I did, and you said, okay, cool. But I would just be remiss if I did not take this opportunity to really give a little bit of thought and appreciation for the work, the contributions of Kwame Ture, a.k.a. Stokely Carmichael, who you, of course, knew very well. And so I'm going to turn the mic over to you for a while. And just if you'd be so kind to provide us with a little history. And see, family, I like to go to the sources of things because we read books or we read articles or Wikipedia or other things, and that's cool. That gives us a lot of information and insight. But to talk with people who were there or who walked the walk with folk, that's priceless. That's priceless. You are not going to get that same vibration when you read it and when you hear it. So I'm going to turn the mic over to Baba Bambozi and have him to share with us some insight and information about the great Kwame Ture.
Thank you, my sister. Let me just say that, you know, the student movement in the U.S. have always been a very interesting movement. And the point that it was young students, grade mm-hmm. school students, who in 1956, 57 began the student sit-in in Woolworths and places like that in Oklahoma City
mm-hmm.
that led to the February sit-ins in Greensboro, North Carolina, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that out of this movement and the ability of students all across the country to begin mobilizing instantly and picking up the examples of Greensboro, there was a conference held at Shaw University in 1960, in April 1960 to be exact, to form a movement that initially was taught off as being the student arm of SCLC.
Mm-hmm.
However, out of this conference came the birth of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and always said that one of the things he regretted in his life was not being at that first conference. But once SNCC was formed, he immediately joined, coming out of NAG at Howard University and moving directly into SNCC, working his way up to chairman by 1964, and you know where it led to from there. And so by 1964, SNCC took off the gloves and decided that we were going to move forward irregardless of what other folks think that students, especially African students, should be doing in this country at that time. So by 1966, you see Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee saying, we're going to take up the Medgar Evers March after he was shot. And leaving out of Memphis, coming down through Mississippi, they decided in Oxford that we're going to not just take up the march, but we're going to say that the reason that these white people in Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia and South Carolina and North Carolina can treat us like they do is because they have the power to do that. And what we need is power. We need the same kind of power so that they can't do that. Point we say what we need is black power.
Yeah.
And it is from that point that the direction of the student movement and the youth movement inside the United States changed. It became more militant. It became more confrontational. It became a process in which people were saying, we ain't taking no. We're not taking no as an answer to any of our demands anymore. And as you were saying, you could see the effect of that in the universities where students were saying, hey, you want to tell us no? We'll just take over the administration building.
That's
we'll
right.
We'll make sure you can't do nothing. We'll take over the campus. Look at Northwestern University, University of Illinois. Universities across this country by 1968, students was mobilized. And I say universities, not African universities, but for the most part, white universities.
Right, right.
African students, being the small minority on the campus, were issuing demands and taking over administration buildings left and right. They did take over the administration building at Howard University.
Mm-hmm.
Because Howard University wanted to produce the black bourgeois.
Mm-hmm.
And the
mm-hmm.
students were saying, this is time for us to concentrate on our community. This is not the time for us to be individualistic and think about just making money for ourselves, but we must now come to realize that if our community does not prosper, neither do we, no matter how bourgeois we get. So, you know, you have this movement, and out of this movement, or along with this movement, out of SNCC came also the movement of organizing the youths and the movement of building independent African political party. The Lowndes County Freedom Organization, which had as a symbol a Black Panther because the white folks in Lowndes County, the Democratic Party in Lowndes County, had as their symbol, and SNCC said, well, what animal can attack a rooster mercilessly? And they figured panther. So the Black Panther grew coming out of Lowndes County and became the Lowndes County Freedom Organization. And it was picked up in California by Huey and became the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. It's picked up by Max Stanford in New York and became the Black Panther Party, which was a outgrowth of what Ram had at that time, Max Stanford, called mm-hmm. the Black Guards. And so you had all of these Panthers struggling around the same time, and out of the struggle came the Black Panther for Self-Defense,
mm-hmm.
which many
mm-hmm.
of us see as the third wave of Black Panthers. But the thing about the Black Panthers was they saw themselves not just as a youth organization, but as a political party. And we saw the beginning of the push for independent political parties, black parties across the country. When Kwame Ture married Mary McCabe and was mm-hmm. offered a job as the secretary to Kwame Nkrumah in Guinea, he came back to the United States saying that what Kwame Nkrumah has called for in the Handbook of Revolutionary Warfare is an All African People's Revolutionary Party. And he was the person who began building that party inside the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a development of Kwame Ture starting out as a student and moving to a political party organizer that realized that even as a political party, we must still emphasize the need for students. And folks were saying, well, Ture is crazy and this is nonsense. Why mm-hmm. recruit the students? We ought to recruit the women, or we ought to recruit the welfare mothers, or we ought to recruit mm-hmm. the workers, or, you know, they had the whole list. And our rationale for organizing the students was, one, the students had the time. Two, the students were not constrained by the fact that they were breadwinners. Instead, they had a life, usually with funding to go to school. And they didn't have to worry about getting fired because they were now talking about building a party. And probably most important, students had the ability to quickly grasp political concepts that were new or different, absorb them, and then explain them to the masses of the people and recruit. So based on that, we felt the need to recruit students, and we did that in schools across this country like you have never seen before. And so Kwame Ture spearheaded that. And there is a problem of folks who have been writing histories of Kwame Ture, because usually the history they write just goes up to the era of SNCC. And they don't talk about Kwame Ture after his 4 or 5 years struggle inside of SNCC. And they don't include the 30 or so years that he spent building the All African People's Revolutionary Party and traveling back and forth between the U.S. and Africa, and linking our struggles with other progressive and revolutionary struggles around the world. And so you come to see Kwame Ture stuck in SNCC, like you see Martin Luther King stuck in I Had a Dream.
Right.
And you don't see the other things that people has done. So based on this, I think that there are many people who know very little of Kwame. There is a definite movement to wipe Kwame out of history.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a movement to ignore the struggle of our people to move forward, not just Kwame, but all of our people. And you can see that struggle today with this whole question of not being able to teach about slavery.
I mean,
that's got to be the height of denial and historical revisionism. But this is what we have. This is what we're living with today.
Mm-hmm.
And so it becomes incumbent on us to change that situation, and where these stories, these truths about what happened in our history is not being told, to correct them, to change them, to tell them. So I'm sure your audience may have a few questions about Kwame Ture. I may or may not be able to answer them, but I think that it's up to you to do what we do now.
All right. Absolutely. Well, before we go to our lines, Baba, just let people know who you are, because, you know, I'm talking about you, but would you please share with them who you are?
Well, my name is Bombo Shishango. Mm-hmm. I came here from Jamaica in the 1960s. I was here at the heights of when Bull Connor and other white racists in the South were beating our people on TV and setting dogs on them on the 6 o'clock news every evening. And within 6 months of being in this country, I found a movement and joined it. And basically I have been there ever since, because we have not won yet.
That's right. And if I may, a sidebar, family, because we talked about this today at a session that we were at. Consistency is key. You know, people pop in and pop out, pop in and pop out. But consistency is definitely mandatory when you're talking about fighting this system, fighting the devil, as some say. And certainly with the intention of obtaining victory. You cannot do that, you know, just popping in and popping out and the fadism and things of that nature, which is kind of what we're seeing now. So again, to hear Baba Bambozi say that, you know, he came into this in the 1960s. And again, we have to be very careful with how social engineering want to make it seem that when you get a certain age, oh, you know, well, you're an elder and you shouldn't be doing this, or you can't be doing that, or whatever. Well, I'm here to tell y'all that ain't going to fly. That ain't going to work. Okay? That's somebody else's philosophy. We are taught from the cradle to the grave, if possible. And so again, I just wanted Baba to share with you that, again, consistency is key. And for me, that's how I'm able to gauge things. When I see, I just had an infiltration. I was sharing with Baba earlier. I just had a recent another infiltration, and I do that periodically for certain reasons because I need for people to see how some of this actually works. Meaning, we read about certain things, but to literally present it so you can see it is very different. And so, you know, I just had someone within some of my internal operations who literally got access to some of my information because, you know, she had been with us for actually a couple of years. And so, you know, she handled some of our correspondences. She had some of my information. And she had a lot of our photos, which she now has. I'm going to have to go through some other routes to get that. But I'm sharing that to say that this is real stuff. These things happen, you get over it, but again, consistency is key. No matter what, consistency is key. Baba, one other quick thing in terms of, and then we're going to go to our lines. Family, if you have a question or a comment, you can press one now. I hope you do have a question or a comment because with all the work that we have to do, we need to be asking some kind of questions. So you can press one in a few moments. But again, one of the things I wanted to ask a little bit about Baba Kwame, and it is where he was born, and, you know, what was the transition from there to the U.S. Could you share with us a little bit about that?
Yes, Brother Kwame was born in Trinidad, and he came to the United States at the age of 12, I believe. He went to the Bronx High School of Science. He grew up in New York, and he ended up at Howard University, and that is where he joined the movement.
Mm-hmm.
I must say that Kwame was influenced at his earlier age, though, before he got to Howard, by the street corner speakers in Harlem and New York, and the mm-hmm. fact that in the Bronx High School of Science, some of the students whose parents were top leadership in the Communist Party and the Socialist Movement at that time went to school. So he had that dual experience of socialism and black nationalism from a very young age.
Mhm. Mhm. Okay. And I remember seeing a video when he talked about after, of course, the death of Dr. King, and how at that point realizing that, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, but basically after that realizing that, you know, if these people would kill him, you know, what many call the King of Love and so forth, that it really didn't matter what you did.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I think it's important that, you know, here we are 50 years later plus, and people still think that the leopard is going to change its spots.
Yep.
I mean,
50 years
you know.
Later, and we have the same struggle. We have moved
right.
forward 1 inch and backwards 2.
Yep. Well, that's more than evident. And so we're going to go into that in terms of also looking at what are some of the things we need to do today. And I dare say, of course, one of those things have to be to look at educating our own children, our own students, but that's a whole other conversation. Family, again, if you have a question or a comment, I did see one or two people there. Something happened and you disappeared. So if you have a question or a comment, please press one again because somehow something happened and I lost. Okay, there we go. All right, let's try this again. Okay, caller, we're coming to you at 1-750. 1-750, your mic is open. Welcome to the segment of New Day.
Yes, sister, living on the front line.
Hey, Dr. Foots, how you been?
All right, baby. How you doing, sister? I just want to say I knew Kwame Ture personally. I had a chance to lecture with him at Mega Edwards College in 1980. And when I was a spokesman for the UNIA, Amara Division in Brooklyn, and he was a very strong man, and I remember his main words were, organize, organize, organize.
That's right.
We have to organize, y'all. We have to organize. That was his main thing, was organization.
Gotcha.
And with Dr. King, was nonviolent, Kwame didn't go for that. He said, sir, I don't mean no harm, but I can't be nonviolent. We have to organize, organize, organize. But listen to this, Filet Empress. Goddess,
yes.
I need you to be off the line because your number has changed and I don't have your new number. So if you don't mind, I'd like to have that,
changed.
You know. If you don't put me on hold and go on with your show, congratulations and everything and much success and peace and love and blessings and all that stuff. But I just want to have your number because I need to talk with you about some other things for the Million Women's March coming up, celebration.
Okay.
So.
Okay. Can I call you back on this number?
No, you can't because, no, you can't. I'll leave it at that for now. But I have to put me, if you give me your number on hold, I can hold on no matter what it takes, even if you end the show, and then come back to me.
Okay. Okay. I can do that. Okay.
Okay,
all right.
Then I'll hold on, sister. So peace and blessings.
Right.
Much love to you.
Peace to you. Okay, let's go to caller at 9462. Your mic is open. Welcome to this segment, A New Day.
Greetings. I trust
Mama.
Everybody is well this season. Hi, sweetie. How you doing?
Oh, you know, doing.
My dear brother, I don't know. I'm 71 now. I've been through a whole lot. I'm not sure if you might remember me or if I remember you, but I spent some 30 years in the All African People's Revolutionary Party in the women's wing. And if you look on YouTube, there's a video of the debate between Kwame and Malefe Asante, Pan-Africanism versus African centeredness. And at the very beginning, there's a sister exiting the stage, really long locks down to her ankles. She just finished singing the Nkosi Sikelele. That was me.
What is your name, sister?
Pandi Kante Day.
I don't quite remember offhand, but I might still know you. I was the coordinator of the party's communication center when we had a center, and I knew a lot of the people out of Philadelphia and out of Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I started out in the party in Philly, and then I had to move to Ohio because I was one of the supporters and spokespersons for MOVE. And I guess the Philadelphia police weren't too happy with me. And they kicked my doors and came in on horseback, beat me and my daughters, and beat me into miscarriage. And so some brothers and sisters got together and helped me move to Ohio. And so I was in the Columbus chapter. We spent a lot of time with Chicago chapter and Cincinnati in terms of the party.
You know, the thing about the party is that party mushroomed in about between 1980 and 1986. And there were so many folks who came through the AAPRP who you know, went through work study and still remembers the basic concepts, and who are still struggling for the objective of Pan-Africanism, the total liberation and unification of Africa under an all-African socialist government. And we don't know who they are or where they are, many of them, but every once in a while we run into people who say, yeah, we were there, we did this, we know this person, we know that person. So it's just unbelievable the effect that the work study process has had on people who came through the party, who still maintain the objectives of Pan-Africanism, even if they're doing it inside a different organization or, you know, as support.
Mm-hmm.
So I must thank you, my sister. I'm sorry for what happened to you, but that's the nature of the beast.
That's the nature of the beast. One of the things I loved about Brother Kwame, he was like a big brother to me. He was very personable. You know, he was a big person in the public eye. And then you had little people like me, and you don't expect anybody to notice any of the work you're doing. But he would come to Ohio. He would come to Philly. He would come to Chicago and say, oh, Sister Condi, you get around. And I'm like, huh? You know, who knew? That was one of the things I loved about him. He was very personable. And another thing I liked about him was he was married to my mentor. Kiba was my mentor. She didn't even know it. I sing in 13 languages now because of her.
Well, right on.
So I'm going to yield for others, but I just wanted to touch base and palpate your heart for a moment.
Thank you very much.
Bless you.
Thank you, Mama.
I yield. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. All right. That's what I'm talking about. You know, again, you can't get this stuff in books. Books help and other things, but to hear, you know, and to feel the energy that's who we are. That's what we are. We must not ever forget that, because they're really moving to make sure that we become AI oriented, y'all. And again, technology is great, you know, to utilize as a tool. But listen, folks are living their lives on some of this stuff now. But thank you, Mama. Okay, let's go to caller at 2274. Your mic is open. Welcome to the segment, New Day.
Hello, Empress.
Hey, Brother Adrian, where you been?
Look, we are working. I just left one of the concerts here because we're working on economically revitalizing the area called Scotlandville, the area around Southern University, the one of our great HBCUs. But let me say greetings to your guests, and let me also mention that after I interviewed Bobby Seale, he talked about the organization and the structure of the Black Panthers. The 10-point program, point number 7 being we wanted an immediate end to police brutality. And people need to know this about the Black Panthers. They just weren't a bunch of black men and women carrying guns and leather jackets. They had free breakfast for children programs, which was the foundation of the party. They had free sickle cell anemia, ambulance programs. Different chapters had 22 social programs to identify and trying to solve issues in our community. I just saw the movie Judas and the Messiah, which turned my stomach. Fred Hampton, who was over the Illinois chapter of the Black Panthers, Fred Hampton Sr., and I'm glad Chairman Fred Hampton Jr. is still alive alive and continuing the work of his father. So they were building hospitals. They were building schools to educate children. It was the Black Panthers that identified from a study that, hey, when children are not able to eat breakfast, they don't pay attention in class. A lot of people are not aware that Bobby Seale was over the Gemini program. He was an engineer by trade. Huey Newton, the founders of the Black Panther Party when they started it in October 1966, Huey Newton was a law school student at the University of Berkeley. These black men and women understood law. They understood discipline. They understood how to maneuver. And by law, they were able to carry shotguns, tape recorders, and observe police to stop them from brutalizing black people by looking at them in a reasonable distance according to the law. And then when they went to the state capital of California, you know, they weren't even 20 strong. Some of them were even working for the government. They were looking at political party. Political offices, and even after the Black Panthers were dismantled, after the assassination of Dr. King, and they were dismantled, you still have some of the Black Panthers who are still alive, still speaking and writing on university levels. You know, Kathleen Kiva and Angela Davis, and some of these individuals who went on trial and represented themselves. Tupac's mother, Afeni Shakur, who was part of the New York 21, who was put in jail unjustly behind a false robbery. See, these were black men and women that we need to identify with today, and I encourage everybody right now to still go and check out the Black Panthers 10-point program because it's still relevant today.
I say. Thank you, my brother. And, you know, you're absolutely correct. At the same time, it's so important that we kind of really know and understand the fundamentals. And what I mean by that is, and again, Baba Bonfosi mentioned or indicated that it was Stokely Carmichael, as we know him as Kwame Ture, that influenced Huey P. Newton. You see,
mm-hmm.
and so I think it's, again, we would be remiss if we did not, you know, make it clear that those first stands was done in the South, and it inspired others to then proceed in the North or in the West, as it may be, as it was. So my point is that the work to, at that time, of course, it was, you know, to get people to vote. But we have to realize, even though we can sit back today and now and go like, well, you know, that's not a big deal. You got to remember, 1960
mm-hmm.
in the South,
yeah.
going to people go vote, do some voting. Man, that was like, you know, putting a bullseye on your body. And so this is what Baba Kwame and others were doing at that time. To get people organized to be able to vote and then ultimately to be able to deal with self-defense, you see. So I'm saying that to say that it was these actions that really helped to, you know, to influence and to mobilize others, you know. And again, see, that's the part of the story that you don't often hear. And again, yes, the Black Panther Party did incredible work. In fact, we talked about them today, Brother Adrian. A sister came to our session, and, you know, she talked about that they do food giveaways and clothing giveaways. And I said, you know, that's wonderful. That's absolutely wonderful. I said, however, we have to put this in the context. Because the Black Panther Party was doing that 50 years ago, and they weren't doing it once a month or once a week. They was doing it every
day. Yeah, it was every day.
And doing it in 25 cities. So when we do the comparative analysis, we've got to be a little more in-depth nowadays, because if we don't speak truth to power, if we don't put the fuller picture out there, because this was a younger sister, and so she only knew what she knew or what she thought she knew, right? And that was, you know, we're doing them. You know, we're giving food away. And it is, that's a good thing. People need food. But
if people don't know the history of certain things, then, you know, they can't really continue it in the same spirit. And this is what
let me just
finding.
Add to that, sister.
Yes.
That, you know, while we talk about the Black Panther Party, we have to also look at the fact that there's still a number of the Black Panther Party members who are locked up behind prison walls inside this country, mm-hmm. who we still have to fight to free. And
yes.
we can't fall down on that struggle. That's a struggle that we must always lift up. I had the opportunity to meet Brother Jalil Montequan in Venezuela
yes.
about two weeks ago. And that brother, after spending all the time that he did in solitary and coming out of jail, is strong.
Yes.
And,
yes.
you know, when you see that there are other people like that still locked up who needs to be released also, we have to fight against this debt by imprisonment.
Yes,
yes.
sir. And not
yes.
just Mumia Abu-Jamal. Also, that's how I got into some type of contact with the Angola 3 at the time, who a lot of people weren't aware that they were part of the Black Panther Party. And I'm glad the elder was able to bring that up, because there's still a fight. See, some people romanticize the Black Panthers, and I understand what you're saying, Sister Empress, of how looking
mm-hmm.
at death, because sometimes we romanticize things. We romanticize.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, they had the guns. They went to the went to the governor's
mm-hmm.
mansion. But the system of COINTELPRO that put a lot of these black men and women on trial, and some of them in prison who are still in prison and in solitary mm-hmm. confinement, some of them were on death row for several years and the whole nine. So we have to look at that aspect and fight a crooked system that worked towards dismantling the good works that the Black Panthers are doing, and some of them still doing to this day, even though some of the original members, even though the Black Panther Party so-called doesn't exist, because I know we celebrated 50th anniversary, they're still doing work. And speaking of Kwame Ture, our bus boycott was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana in 1953, but Dr. King, Rosa Parks, and others came to Baton Rouge to find out how to organize a boycott. Within 7 days,
mm-hmm.
the city had a lot of businesses lost money, the gas companies
mm-hmm.
lost money, bus companies lost money, and this is what happened in Baton Rouge 2 years before the Montgomery bus boycott, where Dr. King, Rosa Parks, and several others came to Baton Rouge. Find out how to organize a bus boycott. Kwame Ture
mm-hmm.
originally was born in Trinidad, which means he already had international connections.
Mm-hmm.
And he died. He was a citizen of Ghana, and he'd been to several other places. And even at the time he couldn't stand up more than 20 minutes, he was still speaking on behalf of black people.
Yep, I remember that. Yes, he was. There was a union strike at the hospital, and I remember him sitting in the wheelchair at the protest. Yes, indeed. You're absolutely correct, Brother Adrian.
That's right. I tell you that at that time, they had a blockade on Libya
mm-hmm.
in 1998, and
mm-hmm.
Kwame Ture knew that he was dying, and
mm-hmm.
the Libyans were sending a plane for him to take him to the hospital. He said he did not know if he would survive the plane trip, but if
mm-hmm.
nothing else, he would die breaking the blockade on Libya. And I think
mm-hmm.
that he took a similar position on the question of Cuba, where he said,
mm-hmm.
just like Malcolm, we should wed ourselves to eliminating the blockade on Cuba. So, yeah, all the way to the last second of the last minute of the last day, Kwame Ture fought.
That's right.
And I think he set an example for us.
Absolutely.
And even though he didn't have any money, somehow he was able to still do these things.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, this again is something we should point out, because again at our session, and by the way, big ups to Brother Shep. He came in. He's an original Black Panther, and he came in from New York to join us today. He will be doing a political prisoner session for our Queen Mother Moore weekend, and it just shows you that these Negroes in Philly who be talking all this stuff, you know, they can't find the time to attend something like that, but folks from other cities can. And I just want to point that out to just show we have to really begin to examine not only the various, you know, obvious contradictions, but also what is impeding our capability as progress. And by the way, big shout out to Sister Pam Africa, Brother Razakhan. They were at our session today. Of course, we talked about Mumia Abu-Jamal. And also, I'll go back to Brother Bambozi. We had a brother today representing Iman Jamil Alameen. So as Brother Bambozi
talked about,
yeah, we had him today. And Brother Jalil will be coming to Philly to be with us for the Queen Mother Moore weekend. Yep.
Great.
He was one of the first to sign up. So, you know, so again, I I'll say this again, family, consistency is key. And in talking about Baba Kwame Ture, as Brother Bambozi just mentioned, you know, he up to his last breath, he was fighting. And this is what we have to now look at. This is not a fad. This is not, you know, a moment in time. This is about liberation, and if you're really about it, then it becomes a major part of your being. It's not a sidebar. It really isn't. I mean, for some it is, and that's okay. That's okay, because we were taught, you know, hey, meet folks where they're at, embrace them where they're at, so it's all good. So don't get me wrong. I'm not saying everybody got to do this or do that. I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is I do believe we're losing focus. in whatever area you're in, we're losing focus. And we need to begin to touch base with that because the enemy ain't playing. Not that they ever did, but they're advancing their stuff. Best believe it. They are advancing. They sending, hey, y'all, they sending submarines to go look at the Titanic.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, look, they got spare time to do all kinds of stuff. Right. So, you know, but, it is what it is. But thank you, Brother Adrian. I'm glad to hear back from you because I've been calling you. I hadn't been able to touch base with you. But we're moving forward with Recharge Genocide 21, so I just wanted to kind of get some updates to you. So check in with me next week.
Okay.
And thank you for your comments, brother.
And one more thing, Empress Elder, I don't know the brother's name because I didn't catch the beginning of the program, but thank you for your sacrifice and you and others who organized and took time to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Baba's name is Bambozi Shango. Bambozi Shango. If you Google him, you'll come up with quite a bit.
Okay.
Okay. All right, my brother. Thank you much. Okay, we got one more here. I believe we're going to go to caller at 7. Oh, I know who this is. Some numbers I do recognize. 7492, you're in the house, and you are now. Oops, wait a minute. Let me open up. Your mic is now open. 7492.
African, good evening. How you doing? Good for the government.
Hey, Brother Lee, what's going on?
I see you up tonight trying to start some trouble. You and that boy Bambozi. Why are y'all on this radio show trying to start some trouble? That's what I would want to know. That's my question. We need peace.
That's our job.
Hey, Baba Kwame said, organize. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's our job, brother.
That's right.
Now, I just would like to make a comment to your listening audience in terms of when we look at someone like Kwame Ture, we should never look at him as Joseph Pernell Joseph once stated in his book, a rock star. He was not a rock star. Kwame Ture typifies what an everyday brother can become if they just develop the will and the love of their people. When you have a chance to be around Kwame and work with Kwame, you will realize he's just an everyday brother like anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things he's done in his early part of his life that we must teach our youth is develop a discipline for reading. It's important for us to read and study. It's to read and study. It's through the people demanding that Brother Ture, you know, read and study. He became a very, very, very important tool to help advance our people that move it. And that's the only difference between Kwame Ture and everyday brother on the corner. It's about love for your people, read and study, and you apply to read, and you apply to study. The more you apply it, the better you understand it, the more you be effective in articulating it. And I think that's one of the legacies, I think, for me, that I would leave when I think about Brother Kwame Ture. You would just, with the other animals, you just feel like he's one of us. There's no difference between me, you, and him. No more than he made a commitment to read and study for his people and to do it in an organized fashion. If you really love that people, like you would say, then you would be in an organization. You're organized for your people. If you're going to defeat the enemy, you can't defeat an organized enemy being unorganized. So again, today, more so than ever, one of the legacies he left is that people must be organized. You must be organized. One of the things he often will say is, Africans don't need leaders. They need what? Organization. The organization, you develop your leaders. You're not talking about spokesperson. Anyone can get in front of a mic and camera and say they're a leader. But if a leader don't have an organized base, if it doesn't come from the people, then it's an issue. So anyway, I just want to throw that point out there. The brother was an everyday brother who loved his people, and he understood the question of discipline and reading and studying. And you got to take reading and study as a serious discipline. And you're talking about changing the world that we live in. You can't change the world by looking at 8 hours a day of TV when we are so behind and things are going so fast. You can't change the world today when you talk about the enemy has what they call social sciences, where they're creating social conditions to get people to create the response to things that they want to create, and they are as conscious of it. The whole question of social engineering is one of the signs, and we need to understand that. So anyway, I just want to make those points, and we'd like to thank you as well for doing what you're doing, and Brother Bamboshi, stop coming on the radio show and causing trouble. But good show. Thank you all for everything.
Thank you, Brother Lee.
Brother Lee.
Yeah. Well, we're not
but starting. Sister, may I make one suggestion, though?
Surely.
In terms of your student conference, which I think is very important, is key today, but I think that you should also ask the students to look at our brother Sammy Young, Jr.
Oh, yes.
Sammy Young, Jr. was a student at Tuskegee.
Yes.
He was a member of Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and he was one of the first students from Tuskegee to be shot by a racist in Haines County, Alabama.
Yep, I remember. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we definitely will. I mean, again, we want to look at, you know, any and all things relevant to students. That's the focus, because we want to instill and empower our students, present and future. We want to give them that information / ammunition so that they know that it's not just about going to school to get a degree, to work for MASA or whomever, that there's some other elements to this. And it's on us, it's up to us to try to do more to instill in them that, yeah, go get that information, education or, you know, indoctrination, but make sure you take some part of that and apply it to our people.
See, that message, that right there is really a part of why we're doing these, getting ready to do these conferences, because we want to make sure that they have that kind of message, you know, and subtly, you know, we're not trying to bash, you know, force anything, but we are diplomatic enough to make sure that it is understood that there are responsibilities. Other groups of peoples have responsibilities that they instill to the younger folk, that they know that, yep, go do that, go do this, but make sure you put some of that back over here. And we have to now make sure that we're doing that, saying, and of course some are, but we have to be, I think, a little more adamant about it and a little more, as Brother Lee said, a little more disciplined about it, that it has to be a real point that's being made, that we're not trying to tell children, are you, yeah, go get your education. We can't leave it at that. And that's, unfortunately, that's what's happening. Yeah, go to school. Get your degree. Pick a good college and all of that. But we're not hearing.
You know,
yeah.
Sister,
go ahead,
what,
my brother.
What you're
yeah.
saying is the exact same thing that the Cubans are saying. They're saying, we'll teach you to become a doctor for free. We'll give you whatever books and food and housing that you might need as a resource, free scholarship in Cuba to become a doctor. And all they ask is that when you become a doctor, that you take those skills that you have learned back to your community, your usually underserved community, and give them some medical care for at least 1 or 2 years. Then you can go wild, make money or whatever you want to, but at least you owe your people. Serve them first.
Yep.
And shouldn't and be just the students in Cuba who does that, but students throughout the U.S. who are now in these white schools are only in the white schools because of the struggles that was waged by their people in the 60s and 70s. So
right.
they owe
That's
their
right.
people.
Yep. And you know, Baba, in reality, and again, we have to speak truth to power. In the Ivy League schools, for lack of a better terminology, now I'm just going to say for entities that are intentional in what they plan to do for the future, most, if not all, of those institutions make it very clear to at least a segment of their students that they must do certain things. See, that's made very clear to them. That they help to do certain things for their people, for their people. You see?
Well.
With, you know, be it directly linked to their family, which is going to be linked to some other stuff, but I'm saying that it's a known fact that there are institutions of so-called higher learning, academia, where for off-white folk, a certain level of them or class of them, whichever you prefer, and even, no, can't say class because I know some that ain't in that class, they're still given these instructions about, you know, their responsibility to their communities. And I'm saying again that we are not expressing that to the degree that we should. We know that that is sometimes said in the various sororities and fraternities that they're supposed to be serviceable, you know, to the community. But I also know, having watched it for 20 years, that oftentimes means a connection to the corporations. You see?
Exactly.
That those programs and those
communities,
right.
our yep, communities yep. need more than just welfare and Boy Scout services.
Or to be able to have a corporation to put their name on something that they're sponsoring. And they're utilizing our people in terms of, well, we're going to bring a service to the community, but then what's really going on is it gives the corporations the capability to use us and say, well, you see, you know, we good guys. We gave. Right. So I guess you're right, Brother Lee. I guess we are starting a little trouble here. But the point is that, you know, we have to call this stuff the way it is. You know, because I'm hearing often people say, oh, you know, we're just doing business. No, you're not. You're being pimped. You're being pimped. Stop it.
Well, folks who had slaves said they were just doing business, too.
And sometimes it's not even being pimped. You're just being exploited, you know. And this is what has been going on now. You know, we had a festival here called Odunde. Well, it's still here. It's actually like 45 years now. I used to love to go to Odunde because, man, you couldn't – that feeling of being with our people was just incredible. And then after about 25 years or so, they decided that they was going to start, you know, meshing more with the corporations. So now the electric company, the gas company, the telephone company, the you name it, are all sponsors, right, of the oldest African street festival in the country, I think it is. It's either the second or the first, right? My point is we don't embrace things like other people do, right? There's certain Chinese events you ain't getting here in Chinatown or the area here. They will relegate, you know, something or some things to, you know, to do joint partnerships with other people. But then they got some stuff that ain't nobody going to get in that. Ain't nobody getting in that, y'all. We an easy sell.
Well,
okay.
We need organization, sister.
Yes, sir. Well, that's what MWM
is. I must thank you for your attempt to build and to bring together our sisters.
Well,
we need them.
Brother, as you, our brothers too. That's why I called you. No, and I'll make it very clear, you know, and again, my area of expertise, and I do make a little difference with you, Brother Lee. You're right. Baba Kwame and others are just brothers and sisters like us, but we have, for me, I have to be fair. And what I mean by that is this. We all have, for the most part, some area of expertise or some area that's a little more, I don't know what word to use for that. And so, you know, it's just like a person that invents something or, you know, does something that's kind of not, you know, in the norm, right? But my point is sometimes people have a certain capability, gift, or whatever you want to call it. And for me, I'm going to tell you, I don't listen to just anybody. Most people that know me, they'll tell you, oh, that sister, she's rough. She ain't going to listen to you. They're right. I'm not, for the most part. You know, I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm reasonable, but on some other stuff, nah, nope. So my point is, there's some people that have just something. And I'm not going to try to lessen that. And it could be with any of us in a different way, right? It could be music. It could be science. It could be art. I'm not very good at certain things, right? But then there's some things I'm top-notch at, okay? So my point is, I have to make sure that I do, you know, give proper due. And in this case for me, I'm not easily impressed. I really am not. For whatever reason, I'm just not. And I've been like that all my life. So don't get me wrong. This didn't happen. Oh, well, you did the million. You were right. Nope. My mama would have told you. Quick story. True story. You know, it goes back to Baba. I was about 11 years old. And I was getting in trouble in school because I never liked school, never. I got kicked out of first grade when I was at Catholic school. They kicked me out. So my parents sent me to public school. But I never liked school. So about 11, I was kind of like a problem child, they would say, or, you know, during that time. And there were some issues. And then I started, like, you know, not going to school, right? And so my mama would say, you know, da 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 da, and she said, "Well, you have to listen," and da 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 da, and I said, "No, I really don't want to." And now, no, I'm 11 or thereabouts, and so she says, "Well, you know, you can learn from anyone. This is a true story, y'all. I forgot the whole dialogue, but she said you can learn from anyone, because I think I said they, you know, they can't teach me nothing, something like that." And she said, "Well, you can learn from anyone," and I said, "No, ma'am. I said I can, but I choose not to." I said that around 11 years old, y'all. So if y'all think that I got like a big head because of the Million Woman March, guess what? Nope. Sister Pam will tell you, she knew me long before the Million Woman March. I was the same way then. So my point is, going back to Baba Kwame, you know, sometimes just people just have a certain something. I don't know what to call it. Again, you find it in music sometimes, you find it in art. The articulation, for lack of a better word, I'm not sure if I made that up, but his capability to articulate for me was just different from others. You see, it just had a different sound, it had a different ring. And so when I heard his speeches or heard his words, it just had a different impact. And so, and I have to say that because, you know, I understand that we have to, not over-grandize things, but at the same time, we can't underscore it either. That's not right either. So, you know, just my opinion on that. Let's go back to Baba Barbosi. Baba, we're moving us forward. We've gone a little bit in the past. Let's go forward a little. What can we now do? And I've asked this question from many over the years. We see what problems we're in, and particularly now, after COVID, or from COVID up to now. Now, I don't know where you are right now, Baba, but the air is unsafe. We just had another alert here in Philly of the air, you know, being a big problem and in other parts of the country as well. So with that said, what can we now begin to really do to begin to advance in our struggle? Uh-oh. Baba Barbosi, did I lose you?
Hello, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay, there you are.
Yeah. I say what we probably need to do is not nothing that's new. It's the same old thing that we have been talking about. First, we need organization. We need to organize. Uh-huh. If we have no organization, there's really nothing we can do as an individual. We can stand there and wish that things would change, but to change things, it takes more than us. It takes people organized. And, you know, Kwame Ture always said that if one person could change things, he would have done it. So.
Yes, I remember that. Right. So with that said, and I agree, that's a part of it. So in doing that,
let me add to that,
okay.
You know, what we've been doing is organizing us as a people, as a country, as the United States. And we have not really reached out to the rest of our diaspora because some of the same ships that brought us here dropped us in other places. And our people in other places are suffering some of the same problems that we're suffering here. And it's not just us. And
right.
we need to reach out to them, and we need to get them involved and to be involved in what they're doing and their struggles.
Right,
and to
right.
see and understand their struggles. The African diaspora is very large. Very large.
Right.
I think that when you look at diaspora, we think that we are the largest population of Africans outside of Africa. But the population of the entire Caribbean is larger than the population of Africans in the U.S. The population of the Africans in Brazil are larger. And there's questions about the population of the Africans in Colombia. I was in a little place called Buenaventura, which is on the Pacific coast of Colombia. And
mm-hmm.
there's no question that that is Chocolate City. No question at all.
Right.
And I understand that on the northern and Caribbean coast of Colombia, it's the same way. So, one, we have to identify these diaspora communities and get involved with them. But even more than that, we need to ensure that we're able to eliminate the issues in our continent, in Africa. The
mm-hmm,
neocolonialism
mm-hmm.
that's running rampant. All of these so-called leaders whose interests is the interests of capitalism and imperialism instead of the interests of the people of their country.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
definitely we have to get AFRICOM out of Africa.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So, you know, again, I think to our advantage, with that said, that we are a lot more capable now, I dare say, than, you know, more so than ever, to now really do that. And what I mean by that is, over the years, of course, you know, the argument has kind of been, well, you know, we need to take care of home base first or what have you. And so now, in this day and age, with the capability particularly of technology, because, again, you know, with MWM, we've been able to connect with our sisters and brothers throughout the diaspora by way of, you know, Zoom and other virtual platforms. We didn't have that before, you see. So I'm saying that what you're saying, Baba, now, you know, for me and others, definitely is something that is a lot more doable because we have the technological means in particular to connect. There's really no excuse now, or at least there's less
exactly.
of an excuse of being able to connect because, you know, before we just pretty much just had the telephone and that was it. That's not the case now. So certainly what you're saying is definitely not far-fetched, nor anything that cannot be done and done readily, done very well, you know, done pretty easily. You know, again, I think these dialogues are very, very important. And family, as I conveyed to Baba Babozi earlier, you know, because our program is recorded, as Brother Lee and Sister Keisha and others, we have reference points where we can now say to people, you know, in our conversations or in our meetings, we can tell them, listen, you know, go check this out. You know, it's readily available now, this information. And we're not talking about just from, you know, YouTube or, you know, the stuff that YouTube puts out there, but based on what the content that we're putting together, even though we're using the YouTube platform and other, it's still our content. And so we
yes.
now are able, you know, to tell people that they can do that. So again, hey, we as they say, we're on the move. We're definitely on the
right
move.
Right on.
I'd like to, before we close out with you, Baba, I found a couple of clips, but I'd like to share this one with the family, if I may. And family, if you have any more comments or questions, we're going to get ready to close this segment out. Unfortunately, Brother Kazi will not be joining us this week. He has some other things that came up, but he will be joining us soon. But I want you to check this out. I hope it's going to come through well because my apparatus has died on me, so I'm going to try another way. So check this out.
The second battle that we're now fighting is whether or not we will have the right to use the terms to decide how our movement is going to work. They don't want us to use black power. I got news for them.
Okay, my apologies, family, for the quality of that. My other apparatus died on me, but I wanted to at least have you hear a little of something from Baba Kwame. And again, and you know, I wanted to focus on that phrase, black power, for a reason, because here in Philadelphia and other places, I run into a lot of opposition about black, you know. You know, we shouldn't be saying it. We shouldn't be using it. And I realized, or come to the conclusion that anytime your own people are telling you that you should not do something, you need to investigate where that's coming from, for real, for real. Because with all the energy that's being put into trying to, you know, degrade that, there must be something else to it. And I've come to the conclusion that that's a very intentional thing, meaning that phrase and that concept was so powerful that the enemy had to make sure that we never latched on to anything like that again, you see. And so I just wanted to reiterate that we cannot allow you know, others to try to diminish or to try to switch things around. And here's the point that we made, and it's this. In my research, I ran across something that I found very interesting. I'm not going to go into it just yet, but I will say this. When you present the argument of the concept of black, right, and again, that time period really elevated and propelled an idea, a thought process. And remember, Baba Bambozi, I oftentimes say to folk, Stephen Biko was born in Azania, South Africa, but yet Stephen Biko was also known as the father of black consciousness. And in several of his speeches and presentations and writings, he talked about black in many different ways. So the argument or the concept is, if here we have a man who was born in Africa, yet found the need or found it to be important to always give reference to black.
Why do you think that was, Father?
Well, I think that for the Africans in the Zania, it's undoubtedly no question that they're Africans. But Steve Biko himself said that what he wanted to point out was that the whole notion of black power coming out of the southern states in the United States was what the people in South Africa needed to lift apartheid, to get out from under apartheid.
Yes.
And based on that, he talked about developing a philosophy of black consciousness.
Yes.
A philosophy that says that we are one people who need power, that these white people who are stripping our mines of gold and diamonds are people who came here as invaders. They're not Africans, and they're definitely not black. But we are not conscious of who we are as a people. And so, therefore, Steve Biko, and again, Steve Biko worked students that got shot up in South Africa in Soweto were students. They were youth.
Yeah.
And that is who he was raising this question with. And many of them, again, today, who came out of the black consciousness movement in South Africa and came to the United States as students, today are in the leadership in South Africa.
Oh. Yes.
And they do have this consciousness. They had this consciousness when they were in the U.S. We work with them. We know. But definitely the uprising in Soweto, where the students said, we ain't going to learn no more goddamn Africana.
Yes.
We want to learn Zulu. We want to learn our own languages. That's when the apartheid government decided to shoot up the students. When they took to the streets saying, we ain't going to take it no more. And not only that, they were they took to the streets hollering black power. In 1976,
1986. Just to give a couple of quick comments, I mean, not comments, quotes, Stephen Biko, being black is not a matter of pigmentation. Being black is a reflection of a mental attitude. Black is beautiful. Black consciousness is an attitude of the mind and a way of life. The most positive call to emanate from the black world for a long time. Stephen Biko.
Well,
truth.
That's what I'm talking about. That in all reality, we have influenced the struggle of our people throughout the world from here inside the belly of the beast. And we must be conscious of that. And we must also continue to struggle inside the belly of the beast. But we must also know that our people around the world are struggling also.
Yes, yes.
And not just our people, but many people are struggling against this same entity here in the U.S., capitalism and imperialism, and they're waging a struggle for their life. All of these sanctions that the U.S. is putting on different countries. Currently, the U.S. have almost half the world population on the sanctions. Sanctions is an act of war. Sanctions kill. And, you know, we have to realize that and realize how many of our people it affects. How long has Zimbabwe been on the sanctions now? Eritrea.
Mm.
How long has Eritrea been on the sanctions? You know, when you look at Cuba, Cuba's a black island.
Mm-hmm.
On the sanctions for over 60 years. And they themselves admit and say publicly that the purpose of sanctions is to starve the people where they rise up and overthrow their government.
Right.
They have a program that's called regime change. So, you know, it's our people that are starving. It's not just anybody being starved.
Wow. Well, needless to say,
my
family,
sister, thank you.
Oh, I thank you, Baba. I thank you. We're going to get ready to close out for this evening, and I can only say that this has been truly an enjoyable, not only enjoyable, but informative conversation. Again, thank you for taking the time to share with us. And, you know, I certainly look forward to getting you back with us again soon.
Thank you so very much. And, you know, I'm always at your call.
Yes. And as I said, you definitely are, you know, I would be remiss if I did not say that, you know, these past two decades have been extremely complicated, but there are a few people who, you know, have definitely, you know, held the post, held the line, as they say. So again, you know, big salute out to AAPRP, PG. You know, again, it has been an honor and a pleasure, you know, to build and work with the brothers in particular. All right, Baba.
Thank
listen,
you, my sister.
Before you head out, is there any updates that you want to share with us in regards to Cuba or Venezuela?
Well, I would like to say one thing about Venezuela. And, of course, you know that right there in New York, they just passed a resolution from the city council saying lift the blockade on Cuba, which is one of many resolutions that have been passed around the country over the past 5 or 6 years. Passed one in Seattle, there's a whole host of country. I think there's currently about 25 cities that have passed similar resolutions. But for Venezuela, I think we ought to be aware of how Africa is disrespected, because there was a Venezuelan diplomat who was on his way to Iran to cut a deal for food, for filters for water purification, and for oil for the people of Venezuela. And the United States, once the plane landed in Cape Verde to refuel, the United States called Cape Verde and said, take this diplomat off your plane and arrest him. We have an Interpol notice that says he ought to be arrested and held. And then we want you to deport him to the United States. But in all reality, there was no such Interpol notice. And, you know, strangely enough, the Interpol notice came the next day.
Mm-hmm.
It's dated the next day after the U.S. took him off the plane. And so we're saying that this man was kidnapped in Africa, in Cape Verde.
Mm-hmm.
And not only was he kidnapped in Cape Verde, but the West African jurors, which is the judges in different countries in West Africa, said that he should be released because it was an illegal detention and Cape Verde had no deportation agreement with the United States. However, they held him imprisoned in Cape Verde until the day before the elections, because the current government, who was holding them, knew that they weren't going to win the elections. And so the day before the elections, he was trafficked to Miami, where he's now in prison. They had him on the 7 charges of money laundering. But when they finally came to the court, they dropped 6 of them. So now there's only 1 charge, which they still cannot prove. And they refuse to accept that the man is a diplomat. And he's a Venezuelan diplomat. First, they said he was no diplomat because he was just a temporary diplomat, whatever that means. And that the United States does not recognize temporary diplomat. Then they said, well, he couldn't be a diplomat for Venezuela because we don't recognize the Maduro government. And so they've been going through all these little Mickey Mouse changes and refuses to release this man. His name is Alex Saab.
Mm-hmm.
And he was born in Colombia, but he transferred his citizenship to Venezuela. And at some point, Maduro elected him as a diplomat to Iran to cut these deals so that the people in Venezuela could eat, could have clean water, and could get gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
And you remember there was 3 or 4 ships of oil coming out of Iran heading to Venezuela, and the U.S. was going crazy and talking about they were going to seize the ships and all this kind of stuff. Well, you know, while it's wild talk, right now the United States is stealing oil from Syria.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's going
mm-hmm.
out of style.
It
is taking the oil from Syria. Talk about gangsterism. Talk about grand theft. But, you know, of course, we go to jail for bunking a check to get $5 worth of gas.
Mm-hmm.
But they just take oil from a country as if the country don't exist. And so they just arrest a diplomat and tell you, you can't arrest none of their diplomats anywhere. And, you know, the reality is diplomatic immunity means that you can't arrest somebody.
That's right.
Wow. So the Venezuelans are struggling that battle and others, but they're doing well. I was just there 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
Sister, again, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Baba. And I'll definitely be talking with you later on this week to follow up on, you know, our other conversation.
Okay, no problem.
All right. Thank you again. Have a blessed evening. Hi, family. We, as you just heard, we just spoke with Baba Bambozi Shango. And, again, there are ancestors, at least for me and MWM, that we will always be not only appreciative, we're appreciative of all our ancestors, needless to say, but of course from an information training, other kinds of standpoints, there are some who, you know, we will always make sure we bring to your attention their work, their contributions, because they have to be put in that context. We were to be involved in a rally that was to take place in Boston yesterday to, you know, protest in regards to a person who, you know, was telling folks that African people, we weren't, the Egyptians, well, they used the word Egyptians, but Kemet people, African people were not black during that era or during that time period. And so there was a rally or whatever that was going to take place that it was postponed or canceled. But the point is, if we do not share our history or bring it forward in the ways that we need to, other people are going to do that. I know firsthand. I've heard stories about the Million Woman March. People didn't know that they was talking to me, and then they would be talking about the Million Woman March, and I just listened, and I'm like, whoa, hey, really? And you did that? You did? Oh, wow. Anyway, the point is, if we don't make sure that we are the keepers of our own history, legacies, cultures, traditions, somebody else surely will. And I don't know if y'all been watching the news lately or reading some things. They're starting to find all kinds of findings all over the world, and they are slowly beginning to suggest that some other people or some other things, but we'll talk about that another time. That's why with MWM and now the Million Woman World March, we're making the declaration of we are representing, raising up the mother of civilization, and we are it. We're going to make that real clear until further notice, we're it. So now that's going to be very interesting because no other group of women have dared to say that. We most certainly shall. Anyway, family, we're going to close this session out. My apologies. I wanted to bring Mumia Abu-Jamal's latest commentary, but having some problems with one of my apparatuses. So next week we should be okay. And we will definitely be bringing you some powerful information. I want to remind you tomorrow, Brother Lee, of course, Africa on the Move. You can check him out 7 o'clock, also on Blog Talk Radio. And, of course, one of our sister stations, Sister Hookups, Sister Keisha, is on every Thursday with Thorough Black Talk. Also want to remind you for Philly, but you can also hear him through the Internet as well. Brother Shamari with the Shamari Show, he's on Fridays. Coming out of Philly WRD, but again, you can also check him online as well, WRD.com. So we're going to close this session out. Big shout out to our National Black Unity News folk. We're going to be doing a powerful campaign. We are looking to obtain our first 100 businesses, but we're really going for 2,500, y'all. I'll tell you about that next week. Again, we know how to raise our own monies to do it with us. In fact, that's, as I started, that's one of our new branding. You will see our actual product called Our Own Forever. Everything. That's a part of our new branding. You'll see a couple of our products coming out with that. Again, we know how to do business, and not as usual, with one another. So we'll tell you more about that next week. I'll be heading up New York this week, family. Of course, I try not to ever miss the International African Arts Festival. So I'll be, you know, with some of my New York family coming week because, you know, they do it for 4 days up there. I think it kicked off today, and it's always until the 4th of July. Oh, we forgot to talk about the 4th of July. Oh, well, we'll hit that one next week, y'all. We're going to talk about that next week. Want to know your thoughts about that and how that's applicable to Juneteenth and other things. But anyway, we're going to close this session out, and we remind you that, again, there can never be any real peace until there's truly maotic justice. And when we say maotic justice, because, see, anybody can say justice. What, you know, what does that mean? What does that mean to just say justice? No. We up in the ante here. We're saying maotic justice. What does that mean? Truth, balance, reciprocity, order, etc. That's what we're talking about. Okay, so, you know, we got to differentiate the stuff now. Anyway, family, we'll talk to you next week. Again, I want to thank everyone that came out today. Oh, man, that was a powerful session. Those who joined us on Zoom, those who came out today, thank you all. It was great. Looking forward for the next one. Until next time, we say Pomoja to the Shinda. Together, we shall win. And guess what? It can't be another 50 years, y'all. We don't have that kind of time.
All right. Some good stuff happened about 50 years ago. We can't wait that long now. So let's get it on, as Marvin said. Talk to you next week. Peace out.